What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint. Yeah, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman.
And it's Legal Face-Off on WGN and WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagles are here. Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini. My name is Sam Panionovich, and plenty to get to today. We'll talk about the rise of hate crimes. Inside Out is back. The legal grab bag as well. But we'll start with the parole hearing yesterday for O.J. Simpson. And we go to F. Lee Bailey of Bailey and Elliott Consulting. And, of course, Mr. Bailey was on the defense team for O.J. Simpson. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Happy to do it.
Great. Well, you were obviously, you know, long legal career, very well-known attorney, and as Sam mentioned, on the dream team for the O.J. Simpson criminal case back in the 90s. Obviously, the breaking news today is that O.J. was paroled yesterday. You've been a close watcher of the entire affair. What are your thoughts on the results of the Nevada parole hearing yesterday?
I thought they fell right in line with the record he's established as a prisoner. I was relieved to hear the members of the board overtly state that they knew there was a lot of input from people who are hostile to the verdict in the murder cases, and they weren't going to consider it, which, of course, they should not. And O.J. really gave his first account of what happened during the so-called heist yesterday, because he did not testify at the trial.
Why do you think that the Board of Parole Commissioners was willing to grant parole at this time?
Well, I think that he met all the criteria, so what they did was not controversial, nor did it run counter to their policies. They have some pretty strict criteria they go by, and if they're going to deviate from those with the result, they have to explain it. There wasn't really any basis on which to turn him down. He's been a model prisoner, never gotten in trouble. He's cooperated with the system. The guards like him. The inmates like him. And I don't know what more you could ask. As he said, I've done everything I could, the best I could.
You mentioned his testimony yesterday. I watched that very intently, as you did, as many Americans did. And you're right, that was the first time we heard his version of this Keystone Cops affair at the hotel room in Vegas, where he was convicted of retrieving his property criminally and of kidnapping. What did you take away from the manner in which he testified? You obviously have years of experience talking to O.J., preparing him to testify. He obviously didn't testify in the criminal case, but what did you take away from his appearance yesterday? He did, at one point, snap at one of the parole hearing officers when he corrected him on, you know, the fact that he wasn't involved in certain ways. He did flash a little bit of an anger. He did show, you know, some contrition. What did you take away as a veteran of someone dealing with O.J. from that testimony?
Well, I have several comments. First of all, I know O.J. fairly well. I lived in the same area as he did after the trial, went visit with him occasionally. And O.J. is O.J. He's a big, garrulous, amiable, affable guy whose only real conflict in his own mind was hitting the line for the Buffalo Bills. But I think that he was upset, as I was, when there was a suggestion that he had an alcohol problem. He never has. And when there was a suggestion that he personally had a weapon in the room, he said he didn't even know there were weapons in the room. And I'm inclined to accept that. So sparking off at those two errors on the part of the board, which to their credit they quickly corrected, is something I would expect of any client who had stood trial for 9 months for something he didn't do. And, of course, if anyone in this world knows he didn't do it, it was O.J., but I think you can add to that the jurors who still stick by their verdict after all the abuse they've taken for being racist and stupid and inattentive. I mean, it's been pretty bad.
Mr. Bailey, what do you think is next for O.J. once he leaves prison? He has reportedly said that at this stage of his life, he would like to focus on spending as much time as he can with family and friends. No, having known O.J. as well as you have, what do you think is next for him?
I have to look back to the time between the acquittal in 1995 and the time that he went to jail in 2008. He got along very well with everybody, played a lot of golf. I took him out to lunch with friends who were uniformly charmed. Many of them invited him to dinner, something you wouldn't really do if you had lingering suspicions that he was homicidal. And he just fit in with the community. I think he will again. Of course, this time, rather than an acquittal, he has a parole, different kettle of fish. He's got to be extremely careful not to get in any minor scrapes, like road rage and things like that, of which he was once accused but acquitted in Florida, and keep his nose to the grindstone. He's eminently capable of that. O.J. is a very adaptable person. He adapted well for being incarcerated for well over a year for a crime that in his mind was no part of his memory or history.
Mr. Bailey, how did the O.J. Simpson trial affect your career as a lawyer, as an attorney?
I've got to say very adversely, which was a bitter shock as I realized that it progresses. Now, the hostility toward me on the accusation that I got him off and otherwise he'd have gone to prison for life has abated somewhat. And I still hear the old maxim, oh, gee, I didn't think you were a nice guy, thought you were a tough guy. But all that aside, the level of people who have remained tenaciously clinging to the notion that he was wrongfully acquitted. And I'm talking judges and lawyers and others who should know better. Indeed, there was a lawyer on the air yesterday saying, oh, I know he was guilty. Well, that lawyer happened to be in the courtroom. And in my view, he couldn't find his backside with both hands. But it's out there. It contributed heavily to getting me disciplined, despite the fact that I took and passed a lie detector test on the issue in question. And I think the O.J. case, like the old case of Dr. Sam Shepard, where I literally began my career, is going to live on and on. I do predict from the fan mail that I get that the coming generation, the so-called millennials, are not going to be slavishly following the mistaken judgments of their parents and employers, which has been a huge problem, and they're beginning to look like they may want a fresh look at the O.J. case. And whenever they are, I'm prepared to give it to them.
Mr. Bailey, last question here on Legal Face-Off, and we'll let you go. The parole hearing, the People versus O.J. Simpson on the FX network, the ESPN documentary have all brought the O.J. Simpson case to the forefront. We've had Carl Douglas on our show. We've had Alan Dershowitz many times discussing the O.J. case. You were portrayed in the People versus O.J. Simpson by Nathan Lane. Wondering how you felt about that depiction and how you felt about the ESPN documentary and the FX series in general. Was it accurate? Did it get things right?
All right. Let me give you a divided opinion. I thought the acting was excellent. I thought Nathan Lane did a good job playing me. He's a good actor. He's a nice man. And they did isolate the key part that brought Furman tumbling down, although the jury later told me they knew he was lying even before I stood up. However, the producers, in order to satisfy public demand, and public demand is you do not portray Simpson in a sympathetic light. The producers yielded to that and changed some critical facts to make it unlikely that Furman had planted the glove, when indeed the jury thought it was likely, and I'm convinced that he did. And I saw the polygraph charts where Furman denied planting the glove, and he just about blew up the machine.
Got to ask you one last question before we let you go. Have you talked to Mark Furman since that day in court?
No, I have no reason to, and I can't think of one reason why I ever should.
That's F. Lee Bailey, Bailey & Elliott Consulting, the website baileyandelliott.com. Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time here in Chicago.
Okay, bye-bye.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, also on iTunes. Just search for Legal Face-Off. Joining us in the studio, we welcome Julie Justice, who's the Program Development Counsel at the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Julie, maybe we should kick things off by talking about what exactly a hate crime is. We've heard about there being a significant uptick, particularly over the last several years, in incidents of hate crime. How do you define a hate crime?
So a hate crime is actually different from a regular crime, a battery or assault, in that it's motivated in whole or in part by a discriminatory intent because of the person's race, ethnic heritage, religion, or LGBTQ status or disability. Under Illinois laws, those are all protected categories. So when you have an underlying crime and the additional bias intent, then you have a hate crime.
Okay, and what are your thoughts as to some of the reasons why there has been such a significant uptick in hate crimes recently?
Well, you're right. There has been a dramatic uptick over the past year or two. And one of the reasons that we attribute that to, and certainly social scientists indicate this is the case, when there's political rhetoric against certain targeted groups, we tend to see a spike in violence against those same groups. So over the past 2 years during the election cycle, certain groups in America, Muslims, immigrants, came under attack. And not surprisingly, as a result, we've seen a dramatic uptick in hate crimes against those very same groups.
What kind of numbers, Julie, are we talking about both locally and if you have any statistics nationally? Is Chicago getting the impact of this more than other cities?
Chicago is about the same as many big cities or across the country. One area where we've seen a dramatic increase is in crimes against Muslim Americans in our city. CARE Chicago, who's a local organization advocating for protecting Muslim Americans, has indicated that in the first 2 months of 2017 alone, they had about 175 reported hate crimes, which was almost half the number of the prior year. So about 400 in 2016, about 175 in the first 2 months of 2017.
So do you feel like people are more comfortable expressing these feelings of hate against minorities now? Do you attribute some of that to the political situation we're in? Do you feel like violence or crimes against Muslims or other minorities are more accepted now? Do you attribute some of this to Trump? I know that's like four questions in one.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think you can mention any of this without talking about the political situation that we're in.
Exactly. I would say all of the above. I mean, African Americans have historically been the group that's always been a focus of hate crime in America. But what we're seeing in the past 2 years is not so much a decline in statistics of African Americans being targeted, but increase in other areas. So Muslims are the one group that raised 67%, I think, last year in terms of reported hate crimes. Undocumented immigrants have been targeted because of anti-immigration rhetoric. I think you're right that people feel somehow freed to express hatred when political leaders are making similar statements.
Which organizations would you say, Julie, have been particularly important on both a local and national level in trying to help combat hate crimes?
Well, I have to plug the agency I work for, which has a 30-year history of protecting individuals who are victims of hate crime in civil litigation. We are Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. And nationally, our national organization has a Stop Hate Project, which is doing a lot to garner resources and put out information that helps folks in all areas who are targeted by hate crime. But our partners in the effort are the Council on American Islamic Relations, ICER, which is the Illinois Coalition on Immigrant and Refugee Rights. The ADL has a great history of doing trainings around hate crime, particularly now they're doing a lot of trainings for state police, which is very important because reporting of hate crime is always an issue, or I should say underreporting of hate crime is an issue.
I just want to talk a little bit more about, you know, the political influence on hate crimes because, again, I think it's a huge issue. We've covered it extensively on this show. I don't think you can minimize the impact of, you know, some of the rhetoric used by people as high up as the president. You know, when the president talks about a Hispanic judge being unable to fairly adjudicate a case because of his heritage, by the way, the man was born in the United States. Mm-hmm. That can't help the situation. That can only have an emboldening effect on people who already have those feelings inside of them. They must think, and as you touched on, that, wow, if the president can call out this person as being unfair because his parents were from Mexico, then I can do the same thing. Then it's not a far step to go and scroll, you know, go home Mexicans on someone's garage.
Exactly. And in fact, a case that I had just a couple of weeks ago would indicate exactly what you're talking about. It involved a Mexican-American woman who was born in this country, who is out at a memorial service for her mother in a suburb of Cook County. And coming home, she was attacked out of nowhere by a white woman who battered her and, prior to attacking her, yelled, "Go back to Mexico. We don't want you here. This is Trump's America." Those were the phrases that came out of nowhere before she physically battered my client. So, yes, that would indicate to me that the kind of rhetoric you're talking about does lead to incidents of hate. Now, other factors are at play. Alcohol is often at play in these incidents. But I think what alcohol does is, in a sense, release the underlying sentiments that just need a little stoking.
Are there some anecdotes that you would like to share with us and with our listeners based on your experience?
Well, I would say that at Lawyers Committee, we've had a number of calls on our hotline asking for help from community members. A couple of things I would like to say. A couple of weeks ago, there was a case at a local Starbucks in downtown Chicago where a white man attacked an African-American man and a homeless man. Sort of out of nowhere, using the same kind of rhetoric of anti-black rhetoric. And bystanders pulled out their cell phones and documented what was going on. And as a result, we have a lot more information that can lead to the prosecution of hate crime in that case. In many cases, what we hear from prosecutors and police is, well, it's a he said, she said, or a he said, he said. What we want to get is evidence of the words and the language that were used.
Julie, what about the rise of social media? That's certainly not a brand new phenomenon, but that has been, you know, growing over the years. You know, everyone, it seems like, opines on social media, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone is a commentator now. Everyone feels free to give their opinions on a variety of things. Do you feel like the ease of accessibility to social media leads to more incidents of hate speech, hate propaganda, especially given the fact that it's anonymous, right? You could pretty much say whatever you want on Twitter, and it doesn't have to be tracked to you if you use some, you know, handle that can't be tracked. Do you think this helps, or do you think it hurts, or is there also a helping effect in that people can express support for some victims as well?
It's a complicated issue, and I would say it's both. On the one hand, as you said, it's a free vehicle for expression. Freedom of speech continues. You know, hate crime laws have never prevented people from expressing offensive opinions. And social media certainly allows for the expression of offensive opinions. But when that expression leads to direct threats or repeated harassment, then we need to do something about it. There's actually a bill pending right now before Governor Rauner that would do exactly that, which would penalize online harassment and cyber stalking, which are not currently protected under the Illinois Hate Crime Act and should be.
What can each of us do as individuals to try to help end the cycle of hate crime?
Well, the first and important thing is to speak out as a community and to say that our pluralistic society does not stand for the kind of divisive rhetoric that leads to hate crime in our community. And to support those who are victims of hate crime, if you're a witness, to come forward and to testify, to provide support to people who are victims, and to be a loud voice against such kind of attacks in our community.
Julie Justice is Program Development Counsel at Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. In the Hate Crime Hotline, if you know anything, if you hear anything, if you want more information, 312-202-3663. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks very much for having me.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.
It's time for Inside Out on Legal Face Off on WGN Radio. We have one half of Inside Out already here. She's now a co-host. That's Tina Martini. And her husband, David Sussler, is the Associate General Counsel with National Material LP, and they do a column in Chicago Lawyer Magazine called Inside Out. So let's bring David in. Hello, David.
Hello.
Actually, Tina called you Sussler. Why does she call you Sussler? She's like, Sussler's on the line. I said, that's strange.
Well, it's my last name. It works.
But you're married. I mean, I don't know. I just maybe, when I get married, maybe I'll call my wife by my last name.
I think we'll call Christina Martini from now on, just Martini.
It's happened before.
So, Sussler, the latest edition of Chicago Lawyer Magazine is July 2017, just came out, and it's on peer mentoring, something that both you and Christina do extensively. Tell us why, David, first, peer mentoring is important in your position.
Well, you know, I think we all need, we can and we need to constantly learn and grow and improve our skills. And, you know, at this stage in my career especially, and I think as people grow in their careers, it's good to learn from your peers. And that can be, you know, other lawyers and business people, especially if you're in-house lawyers. It's really important to learn from your business colleagues, learn what they think about, what do they look at, what do they consider important, how do they conduct themselves, and, you know, watching all that, learning from them helps me be a better lawyer for the company and also just to generally improve my own skill set.
Christina.
Yes.
I think we've met before. you are the other half of Inside Out, the other half of Legal Face.
The better half or the worse half?
Well, we'll leave that for later discussion.
Nice.
But you, in addition to being chair of the intellectual property practice group at DLA Piper, you're also the national hiring partner of associate recruiting at DLA Piper.
Yes.
I got to pause here because that's a lot to say. I'm emotionally exhausted after that, after that title. My title is lawyer, by the way, but Christina's got a lot of roles. So that obviously entails peer mentoring. Yes, something you do all the time. Why is that important, and how do you encourage it at your firm?
Great question. I would say that peer mentoring is very important, especially as you get more senior in your career, because traditional mentoring, as, for example, young associates know it to be, is very different than as you get 15, 20 plus years into your career. Having folks that are contemporaries who are in similar situations, similar positions, for, you know, from whom you can draw experiences in real time is very important. I would say that wearing my practice group hat, I see more of the peer mentoring happening, especially with folks in my group, folks in other practice groups. When you're in leadership positions, it's particularly helpful to get that kind of advice from other folks who are similarly situated.
So the timing of this discussion is great, because literally yesterday at my firm, and we have a small firm here in Chicago, but 30 lawyers, much smaller than DLA Piper, but this is something that we deal with every day. And literally yesterday, we had a meeting about this issue. One of the issues on the agenda was this issue, because someone who had left our firm to go to a different state mentioned that the peer mentoring process could be strengthened. And frankly, at our firm, you know, we don't have the luxury of necessarily having a formalized peer system. We throw people in the mix, for better or worse. You know, we're a firm that doesn't have a ton of time for peer mentoring. You know, we're very busy, as everyone is, obviously, but, you know, we tend to throw people more and in the mix and do on-the-job training than we'd like to. So what's your advice to a firm like mine with younger associates to have that kind of peer mentoring that obviously has a value?
Well, with younger associates, I think that if they start the relationships early among their contemporaries, I think that's one way to do it. I think trade associations outside of their firms can really present another terrific opportunity. I've had that experience where I join organizations or groups, either formally or informally, that give you an opportunity to share experiences, raise questions. And sometimes you need to have that kind of circle around you, not in your immediate work environment, because you're concerned with what people will think if you start asking certain types of questions or ask for certain types of advice.
David, were you ever a mentee coming up? I know you've talked before about people who have assisted you as you rose to the current position. How important was being the recipient of peer mentoring in your career?
Well, you know, as I was coming up and as a young lawyer, mentoring wasn't as focused a topic as it is now and as it has been, say, for the last 10, 12 years or so. So, but that's a great way for me to talk about one of the things that I always mention when I talk about mentoring is mentoring can be both formal and informal. And I have always had informal mentors, meaning we've never explicitly established, hey, you're my mentor, let me ask you questions and teach me. It's more like I watch, I listen, I observe, and I absorb. For example, just yesterday, I had a meeting with our HRVP and our company president about something. And listening to the president talk about what is he thinking about, the questions that he asks us to find out information that are important to him, that's all mentoring, learning what is my president interested in, what's important to the business, how does he conduct himself in a meeting. And I did this as a young lawyer. I'd go to court with a senior partner. You know, I'd second chair a case as a young lawyer. Watch, how does that lawyer conduct him or herself? How do they argue? What do they think about? That's all informal. So that was always key, and it remains key at this stage.
Tina, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal on the 17th, so a few days ago, and the title of it was "When Your Work Pal Is the Office Laggard," and it was a really interesting article. The subject of it was, what if a friend of yours who is a close friend socially isn't pulling his or her weight at work? Do you rat them out to the boss? What do you do? I'm going to ask you that question. I'm sure you've seen examples of that in your role. What's the best way to deal with that situation when you do have someone that you work with that's, you know, just not pulling their weight and not doing the best thing for the organization?
I love that question.
Especially because it's on the fly, right? It's
not,
you weren't prepared for it.
Yes, I'm cool with that. So I think it's all about context and knowing your friends. And so if this friend of mine is pretty self-aware and knows that he is a slacker and really just doesn't have any intention to change his ways, I think it's usually pretty self-evident that the person's a slacker. And so I don't think that I need to rat somebody out when it's pretty evident that they're not pulling their weight. But if it's somebody where there's a disconnect, they think they're doing a great job, but actually they aren't meeting expectations of our work environment, I would actually speak offline to that person first and say, hey, I know that you think you're doing a great job, but there seems to be a disconnect between how you think you're doing and how everybody else perceives you're doing, or how much effort others perceive you're putting into your job. So I would vote for going straight to my friend first, having a very frank discussion with them and seeing where that goes.
I have a question. I'd like to hop in if I can.
Of course. Ladies and gentlemen, Sam Panianovich.
Because I'm in that millennial genre, and I'm not saying this happens at any of your firms, but there are some young associates that probably think like they know everything. How would you deal with that roadblock? Is there any opposition ever to mentoring, and how do you tackle that?
That's actually a great question.
Well, can I jump in there?
Yes, you can. Yes, Sussler, go, Sussler.
Well, for one thing, I would say among the millennial generation, mentoring is typically extremely important, and they seek it out. It's rarely roadblocked by them. So they want it. And you need to sit down and talk with people and say, hey, you know, there's an issue here. Let's talk about it. I don't consider any of it. I have to back up also to Rich's question. I don't consider it ratting somebody out. If somebody is not doing what they need to do or performing below expectations, you either need to have a talk with them directly, or you go talk to the person who is in a position to talk to them. Part of that is being a friend, and a lot of that is being the employee or partner in your firm you're supposed to be. When you reach a level like Tina as a partner or me as associate general counsel, we have a fiduciary duty to the company to protect the company. And part of that is to make sure our employees are performing as they're supposed to be. But before you know, when you say rat them out, that's very negative. And mentoring is very positive. So you want to sit down and explain to them how. You know, you show them by your actions, and sometimes you just show them by your words.
All right, David, let's get to the real reason why we had you on. As always, we remind our audience that you are the world's foremost, or maybe the second foremost, Bruce Springsteen fan. Growing up as a young man, if Bruce Springsteen was the mentor for a young David Sussler, what was the one piece? What would be the one Bruce Springsteen song that would be the best advice for a young David Sussler coming up in the legal world?
Backstreets.
Backstreets.
After all this time to find, we're just like all the rest.
There you go. Riding on the backstreets.
You know.
I think my choice would be, having not thought about it before, but the best peer advice that a Bruce Springsteen could give me would be maybe someday we'll look back on this and it will all seem funny.
Yeah.
Right? Pretty much sums it up. Christina,
I think those are both important lessons.
Yeah, we'll end off with Christina. Any musical lyrics that would be peer mentoring for a young Christina Martini coming up in the world?
Wow. I cannot even think of anything. David, you probably
Sam,
know.
Sam, any inspiration from from the J?
I was going to say you can't
from
start
the
a fire.
Roll, maybe the jaw roll?
No, I was going to say you can't start a fire without a spark, but you can answer for me if you want.
All answers can be found in Springsteen lyrics, right?
And I just have to throw in there. So when I was in high school and listening, really first getting into Springsteen, I'll date myself. I mean, we're talking the mid to late 70s. I had my sister embroidered that verse from Backstreets on a pair of blue jeans for me, the one I just quoted.
Wow. Where are those jeans today is the question.
They're in the bottom of a drawer in my closet. I still have them.
You obviously
I don't wear them, but I have them.
You have to wear them. You have to come in for your inaugural in-studio visit to Legal Face-Off. Just to see those jeans on David Sussler would be quite an image.
Yes, they would. Maybe I'll find them and take a photo and send them to you.
It's Chicago Lawyer Magazine, chicagolawyermagazine.com. Inside Out this month, it's on peer mentoring. David Sussler, you're off the hot seat. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Christina Martini. Bye-bye.
Well, she's here. She's here until the end of the show.
I'm not off the hot seat anytime
soon.
She's here.
Yeah, turn up the heaters, Craig.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Legal grab bag time, legal face up. Tina, we've got seven topics. Seven. The first one,
Trump Watch.
Surprise, surprise.
Coming at you.
It surprises Trump me that we talk about Donald Trump on Legal Face Off. He has shuffled his legal team now.
Where's our Trump Watch music? That's the same as the breaking news one.
Yeah,
again, limited resources.
Sorry,
WGN.
It's been a while since I sang jingles.
Yeah, so Trump, big news coming out of today is that Mark Kasowitz, who was on who's the lead for Trump's legal team, is gone. He is still taking, they say, a lesser role, but he will no longer be the lead. Washington lawyer Ty Cobb, not that Ty Cobb, but
he's dead.
The other Ty Cobb is now the lead. But the really fascinating part is, this is not surprising, Mark Kasowitz, there was a email exchange. Did you guys see this email exchange, hear about it? So Mark Kasowitz, who's a very well-known Washington lawyer, he has represented Trump on his before he was president, he represented Trump in his divorce case. So there was an individual who emailed Mark Kasowitz Wednesday night of last week, and all he said in the email was, resign now. All right, so this is Mark Kasowitz, who's in charge of a major law firm in D.C., who represents the most important man, the most powerful man on earth. And in response to this anonymous email, Mark Kasowitz wrote back within minutes a series of angry emails, one of which read, I'm on you now. You are effing with me. And he actually didn't use the word effing, but the full word. You are effing with me now. Let's see who you are. Watch your batch. Watch your back, bitch. In another email, Kasowitz wrote, call me. Don't be afraid, you piece of S. Stand up. If you don't call, you're just afraid. And then he also wrote, I already know where you live. I'm on you. You might as well call me. You will see me. I promise, bro. So not surprising that a week later, Mark Kasowitz is no longer the lead attorney for the president of the United States. Not probably the best response. He later released a statement saying it was at the end of a long day. He was on trial, and he regrets what he wrote. But, yeah, he's known as a, you know, as a fighter, you know, not dissimilar from words you would expect maybe from Trump. But, yeah, he's out as the lead counsel for Trump.
Number two, Tina, Dennis Hastert, the former U.S. House Speaker who broke the law, tried to hide all that sexual abuse. He is out of a Minnesota prison. He did 13 months behind bars.
Yes. So on Monday, former Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert was released from federal prison in Rochester, Minnesota, after serving 13 months for illegally structured bank withdrawals that were tied to his attempts to silence a former student whom he had sexually molested. The exact location of Hastert's halfway house has not been publicly disclosed, and he is scheduled to be released from federal custody on August 16th. In 2015, Hastert had pleaded guilty to withdrawing a couple million dollars from his accounts as part of a $3.5 million deal to keep his misconduct against one of his victims, Individual A, quiet. Federal prosecutors claim that Individual A was one of at least four boys whom Hastert had molested when he was a coach. In addition to serving 13 months of his sentence, he was ordered to pay $250,000 in fines and to receive sex offender status. It's a very sad ending to what had been a very long and accomplished career in the House.
It's amazing to me, Rich, that this guy was two heartbeats away from being the president.
Yeah, and he's still, as we've covered on the show, being sued civilly for not paying the amount that he agreed to pay to his victim to keep quiet. So the legal jeopardy for Denny Hastert continues.
We have a new law in Washington State. They're calling it the EDUI. This is number three. No more texting, typing, reading, smoking, eating, drinking, or grooming behind the wheel in Washington.
Yeah, one of the strictest driving while distracted laws in the country, just as you mentioned, was signed into law, primarily to avoid accidents from people on the phone. As you mentioned, there are other things that are covered, grooming, reading, etc., but the main focus was, you know, people texting, people taking selfies. There was a very tragic case recently where two people got killed when the driver was taking a selfie, and they released the selfie that he took moments before he crashed and killed these two people. So obviously a huge problem. I think Washington's doing the right thing. You will still have people doing this nonstop. I mean, you know, our cell phones are like crack, right? You cannot put it down. Any few seconds you have at a light, we all pick it up. We all do it every day. This will not only affect people who are actually texting or talking, but literally you cannot use the phone at all in the car. You can't do it while stopped in traffic or just scrolling through a playlist. So, you know, this will affect people who are just using their phones to play music. I think that's the extreme. But obviously the idea is while you're in the car, this is supposed to avoid people using their phones and being distracted.
Well, so, how do you go about enforcing something like this? I mean, that's going to be, I mean, there's probably a lot of people who are just not going to be able to stop right away. And how do you have the resources to enforce something like this?
Yeah. I mean, like now, I mean, you know, most every jurisdiction has laws now about people texting while driving. And the enforcement is, yeah, I mean, if you roll up and police see you doing that, then that's the way they do it. Of course, it'll be tough to enforce. Washington State, where this law was enacted, almost 4,000 distracted driving accidents that resulted in 200 deaths in the last reported year. You know, Illinois is one of the hardest hit states with distracted driving. So obviously a problem. I think it's a good idea to crack down on this.
And it looks like there's several levels to this. If you have a handheld device, your first offense is $136. A repeat offender for a handheld device is $234. And then the secondary slights, which involve smoking, eating, drinking, reading, grooming, $99 a ticket. I'd love to get a ticket for brushing my hair.
Do you shave in the car?
I gave that up for Lent.
What's the weirdest thing you've seen someone do at the
light? Eating a pizza.
A full pizza
in the passenger seat, flipped up, box open, going to town.
Yeah. I've seen some weird things, some things that I can't repeat on WGN airwaves. But, yeah, don't text and drive.
Our fourth topic, and Tina will take this one. I'm just going to let you run with it. The topic I have says judge stalkers.
Yes. So, no.
Sounds like a CBS sitcom coming this fall.
Yes.
Judge stalkers.
So, yeah, so these are not people who are judges and who are stalkers. These are people who are stalking judges, and it's actually a rather disturbing story. There seems to be a flurry of judges who are being stalked both in Michigan and Florida. Judge Vonda Evans of Wayne County, Michigan, and 16 judges in Broward County, Florida, have been victimized by two different stalkers, both of whom have been identified, but only one of whom has been arrested. Each stalker has engaged in rather disturbing behavior. Todd Watson, who is the Florida stalker who has been arrested, has, among other things, written threatening notes, tried to barge into a judge's chambers, and has actually showed up in another judge's courtroom and was taken out when he wouldn't stand for the judge. These stalkers have left the judges feeling victimized and scared. Judge Evans from Michigan said that she saw her stalker everywhere, including when she was walking her dog. She said she first realized that she was being stalked when she got unwanted tweets showing certain body parts of her stalker that she would have rather not seen. She went to the police and learned that her stalker has mental issues and apparently does not have a criminal record. This is pretty scary stuff. I think all of us, especially here in Chicago, remember the tragic story of Judge Joan Lefkoe and her husband and mother. That was in 2005. And I really hope that this story has a happy ending quickly.
Number five involves a former American Idol arrested, Haley Reinhart, who's actually from Illinois. She was arrested early Saturday morning for battery after she allegedly punched a bouncer.
Yes, so I'm taking this one too. So Haley is a native Chicagoan who actually came in third during the 2011 season of American Idol. And as Sam mentioned, she was arrested for battery in a Palatine bar. According to a police report, the police arrived after bar security reported several customers, including Haley, were asked to leave after knocking over a table. At this point, Reinhart allegedly was arguing with security and apparently punched one of the security bouncers in the face. Her version of the story is that she was assaulted by the bouncers at the bar, and after forcefully being removed from the bar, they violently beat up her friend, who sustained a number of pretty serious injuries. Yesterday, in fact, the bartender in the incident, Adam Sobanski, was arrested, and he had apparently put Reinhart's friend's head in a headlock and started choking him. So it's unfortunate that somebody who did so well on American Idol has gotten this type of publicity.
No Ruben Studdard involved in this one, though, right?
He was not. I don't believe he was. I'm sorry.
Haley, not among the most successful American Idol contestants. Not doing as well as some of her contemporaries, right?
Better than us. Better
I
than us
know.
Three. Right?
I mean,
can you
She's
sing?
She's doing better than us?
I'm not so sure
I
about that,
disagree.
Sammy.
I meant, like, I thought you meant musically.
Oh, singing-wise? Yeah, I cannot hold a tune, but let's rank the top American Idol alums. It's got to be...
Well, it's got to be Carrie Underwood.
Kelly Clarkson's up there, too.
Jennifer Hudson.
Didn't Ruben lose to the other guy?
I thought he won.
I thought he beat out Clay Aiken. I thought Clay Aiken won.
I thought Clay Aiken was the winner and that Ruben was number two.
Didn't Clay Aiken run for office somewhere?
I think that's right.
Yeah. Mm. So what about, can you name the person that Kelly Clarkson beat that first season?
Beat on the show or beat at a bar?
Actually, did she beat him or did he win?
We just talked about beating Kelly the bouncer. You have to be
Kelly
careful.
Kelly Clarkson beat who in the finals of the first American Idol? Let's see if you remember that name in history.
I don't.
Craig Collins, remember? No? Christina?
I don't. I actually did not
Emily?
Watch the first season.
No. The answer is Justin Guaridi. Remember? Then they made that movie from Kelly to Justin afterwards. No, am I the only one who remembers the early 2000s?
You could be making this up, and I wouldn't know.
All right.
This is a tough transition.
I bet Haley Reinhart remembers, by the way.
Number six, on a much, much more somber note, R. Kelly has been accused of holding women against their will. He's allegedly running an abusive cult.
R. Kelly. Continues to have legal issues many years later. There's been a woman who is alleging that he has sex robots, that he is keeping women, many of whom are underage, against their will at his various properties and making them do things. The specifics are that he controls every aspect of their lives, dictating what they eat, how they dress, when they bathe, when they sleep, and how they engage in sexual encounters that he records. R. Kelly's civil attorney, Linda Mensch, has told us and has said that she said, quote, "We can only wonder why folks would persist in defaming a great artist who loves his fans, works 24/7, and takes care of all the people in his life." So again, R. Kelly has been in trouble with the law before, and this is the latest allegation. Favorite R. Kelly song? We got to ask that question.
I believe I can fly.
That's a good one.
That's my favorite,
Christina?
Too, by far.
Yeah? No one likes bounce, 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 bounce. We love to bounce that one.
Ignition. I mean, Ignition's good. How about Ignition. The World's Greatest? That was in the
don't know that one.
Ali movie. Yeah, you do. You've heard it. If you heard it, you'd know it.
Okay.
Last one on the rundown for Legal Grab Bag. And I do have breaking news, by the way. So stick around after the rundown for the Legal Grab Bag for the breaking news. We have an ointment lawsuit, according to WGN-TV.
Yeah, I'm going to have a hard time talking about this without laughing. So this case is for all you listeners out there who can't stand not being able to get that last little bit of toothpaste out of your tube. So on July 5th, Judge Elaine Bucklow tossed out Lanham Hillen's class action lawsuit against Blistex, where she claimed that she and others were being cheated because her tube of lip balm could not be completely emptied. The judge stated that most people understand that when they actually buy these types of products that come in a tube, that you will never get everything out of a tube, no matter what it is. So Hillen,
not her, though. She doesn't, apparently she doesn't get that concept. Because she actually filed a lawsuit.
She actually filed a class action lawsuit. Yes. So it's not just her, it's other folks too. So Hillen and the other plaintiffs are considering their options and may file an appeal.
My only question here is, where is Jason Whiteside when you need him? This is the kind of case that Jason Whiteside, our former co-host, would say, oh, this is just the proper adjudication of justice. And this is, you know, for all the victims of ointment abuse out there. Yeah, I mean, class actions, listen, we've covered them extensively. Kind of ridiculous. You know, they're claiming that you can't use 25% of it because it won't exit the tube. Inevitably, the people who make out on class action lawsuits are who? Not the victims, the lawyers, right? So there will be some huge attorney's fees just given the number of people in the class. But yeah, Sam, next time you can't squeeze that little bit of ointment out of your Blistex, you know that you'll be getting a check for about 7 cents in the mail at some point.
Yes. Okay. I can't wait. All right. On to the breaking news. We have a resignation in the Trump administration.
Spicy.
Sean Spicer has
resigned.
Get
out.
Yeah. He has resigned as White House press secretary. According to the New York Times, he has disagreed with the appointment of Anthony Scaramucci as the communications director, and Spicy is out.
And the biggest loser in this whole thing is SNL.
So I was going to say, what is Saturday Night Live going to do with this news?
Poor Melissa.
Who is fantastic.
McCarthy, yeah.
She is fantastic.
But, you know, inevitably we'll see Spicy pop up on a million shows offering commentary. But not surprising, right? I mean, we all saw that coming. I mean, he hasn't been the primary voice for the administration in weeks. It's been, my memory is terrible today, but Huckabee. It's been Sarah Huckabee. And they haven't held press conferences. They're now all holding them without video cameras. So not a real surprise. But, yeah, I mean, things continue to tumble in the Trump administration.
Coming to you soon, the Spicer and OJ podcast.
Let's have Spicer on LFO.
We should call him.
Emily, our booker, is in studio. Get working on it. Get spicy.
I'm sure he'll love to join us.
Yes.
Hard-hitting stuff. Thanks to everybody for making this thing work. Thanks to Craig Collins. Thanks to Jim Holland, the engineer, for coming in and pushing a couple of buttons and fixing everything. Thanks to our guests. And thanks to Rich and Tina. We will see you next time. It'll be August next time you hear from us. And we'll talk to you then on Legal Face-Off.